You are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
My name is Rob Funkhauser, and I'm sitting here with Brian DePauli talking about the opening of his show, Not Sorry We're Closed, which is happening in the Epherson Gallery at Tube Factory Art Space. It runs from August 4th to September 24th, 2023, and deals with subject matter from everyday life, which we're going to talk about, and features not only oil paintings, but illustrations, a neon sign, and an animation. Brian, I want to start with talking about just a little bit of your background, how you got into this, and how you're feeling about where you are right now as an artist.
Okay. So where I'm at right now in my studio practice is mostly focusing on paintings, the representational paintings, the subject matter is sort of things from my personal life mostly right now. And I choose things that sort of represent like leisure or recreation that are important to me, but they could be anything that's like leisure or recreation sort of related. It doesn't really, it's like not meant to be so specifically about me, but something that's maybe more universal about time away from work and how you spend it. And I started working on this type of subject matter probably when I was in a residency at the Luminary in St. Louis, shortly after grad school. And that was in like 2010. Yeah.
Cool. So with this show, the subject matter, I said everyday life earlier, and that is really sort of a very broad way to say something very specific. And as you mentioned, a lot of your paintings are about leisure. I'd like to talk about a couple of the paintings in particular and talk about like how you see these objects relating to experience and whether or not like they encapsulate experience for you, or if you're sort of trying to get at like a broader narrative with some of the things you picked. So one I want to talk about is the painting Retired Hat, which features a hat that says retired and I believe no fax, no phone, no problem.
It says no fax, no phone, no stress, no worries on the hat. And so that hat was a gift from some friends of mine. And, I spent a lot of my life trying not to work full-time jobs so I could focus on being an artist. So the sort of joke with me and my friends is that I'm retired, which is, I mean, not true at all, really, because being an artist, I'm really like working two jobs all the time, but since I'm not at a day job every day, it's sort of like I'm retired.
Right.
And so it's actually a second version of that painting of that hat. I've made another painting of it before, but this version that's in the show, again, relates more to like my personal life in that it's, and also more to leisure than the previous version. Because it's the hat is set in my garden at home. And I never really thought I would be a gardener, but I ended up having a garden because it's actually less work to maintain than mowing a lawn. So it's like personal to me because like the hat was a gift from my friends who like, you know, sort of knew that like that hat would be perfect for me. And then in my garden, like I said, it's really about having less to do chore wise so I can have more time to do things that are maybe more important to me. But over the years, I've actually become really excited about my garden and I get lots of compliments on it. So, like if someone who has never been to my house comes over, they're always surprised that I have such a big garden in my front yard and that it like looks really good. So, even like a couple years ago, a friend who had come over for the first time, we were like pulled up and we're like getting out of the car and she's like, "Oh, your neighbor has such a nice garden." I was like, "No, that's my house." I think she was expecting, you know, me not to have that or whatever, which is like, you know, not a typical hobby, I guess, for, you know, a man in his 40s to be like really into a flower garden, but I am. And I actually do now spend a lot of time on it. Ironically, I'm like, I water it like, you know, every night when the, you know, when it has been, I guess when there's enough rain to where it's not like, maybe a social faux pas to like be watering, but we get plenty of rain in St. Louis. So, yeah, that's sort of the story behind that painting.
Yeah. And it brings to me, it brings to mind maybe a theme of a lot of your work where, thinking, I mean, sort of the pithy phrase in my head is thinking more about doing less in a certain respect, but it's not even maybe so much that as examining what we're doing with our lives and the fact that like maybe a garden seems to be emblematic of like maybe somebody who has it all together in this sort of classical sense, but the drive to say not work a day job and all this stuff is something that you and I share where we're constantly, I mean, I know I'm constantly battling for less hours to find balance in life. And I wonder, is, you know, things like the garden, do you see that those kinds of like slow moving forces in your life, do you think that those influence some of the work you make and how you think about making work?
Oh yeah, for sure. So basically every painting I make starts with like what you're saying, like the, like something that like represents maybe like a slower pace of life. And I've just, and they all like come from like experiences I've had. And I just think it's like a really important thing for me personally, for like my own like psyche and like my philosophy about how I want my life to be, all sort of like sort of goes back to like the slower sort of pace of life. And like, I mean, we can talk about some of the other paintings in here, obviously we will, but like, you know, there's a painting in the show of my bike, seat, you know, and like just that in itself is like a slower way to move through the world. You know, like I was a bike commuter for, I don't know, I mean, for 10 or 15 years or whatever. And, you know, I have a car now and I use it regularly, but I would love to get back to a point where I don't have a car anymore, you know, because you just like, it feels very normal after a while, not having a car. And it's like, it's just going to take me this long to get somewhere on my bike. And that's how long it takes. Just like when you get in your car, you know, it's going to take a certain amount of time to get to your destination. It doesn't really feel any different than getting on your bike.
Right. And in some ways, you know, with the exceptions of maybe like when you have to transport paintings or move big things that do require a car, it can become, owning a car in a city can actually, I feel that it sometimes puts you in the trap of being able to fit more into a day. So if you know you have to ride your bike for 30 minutes to get somewhere, and you know you have to ride another 15 minutes to get to the next place and then another maybe 50 minutes back home, like that's time you get to spend, you know, sort of riding and, I mean, paying enough attention to traffic, but you get to spend that time sort of thinking to yourself and being in your own body. And when you have a car, all of a sudden those things are cut to like 2 to 5 minutes, or, you know, an hour is cut to 10. And
well, sometimes in the city, it's really not.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I'm speaking from Indianapolis, where the driving is painfully easy.
Yeah. In St. Louis, it's, I mean, it almost takes the same amount of time some places to ride your bike, just because, you know, sitting in traffic is, I mean, awful, but like you kind of don't have to do it that much on a bike because you can take side streets and, you know, kind of get around like sort of heavy traffic zones.
But, yeah. And you avoid, I mean, a lot of the psychological experience of waiting.
Yeah.
Even if you're moving slower, you're still doing something the whole time.
Yeah. You still have like forward progress basically the whole time.
Yeah. Let's talk about that painting a little bit. Death Shadow is the name of it. Mm-hmm. And it is a painting of a well-worn bike seat, which is, I think, another thing that I think is a little bit indicated by some of your paintings. You like to use things until they're just completely non-functional.
Yeah, or I fix them and continue to make them functional. I mean, you know, it's all about the same thing, though. You know, it's... I don't want to have a job, you know, to like keep buying new stuff over and over and over again. It's, I mean, it's not the type of lifestyle that I want, but also like from a perspective of like our whole society, we're so quick just to throw something out and get something new. And there are many, many bad outcomes from that. We don't have to get into all of them because, I mean, I think if people want to buy a new bike, if they want a new bike seat, whatever, they're totally entitled to doing that, but it's just not the way that I live my life.
Right.
So, a lot of the paintings that I make are of stuff that I own and they happen to be worn out because I've been using them for a long time. I'm not a, you know, I like getting new stuff. It's just, I don't have much of it.
Right. I wonder if there's something there too, where some of these objects in these paintings, including Death Shadow is maybe wearing its heart on its sleeve, but then the grill painting that's in this show and Wurlitzer, to me, have a thread of like embedded history. Like the objects speak, I would say more so through their history almost than their maybe immediate visual beauty as subjects. Is that something that you intentionally pursue? Like, are you in a sense painting memory, or are you, or am I looking too far into that?
I mean, I don't know if you're looking too far into it. I think it's great when people kind of can look at the painting and sort of make their own interpretation of it, I guess. But, I don't know. I've never really thought about memory as a big part of my work. No.
Interesting.
But I guess like, not like as something that I feel like people would at least pick up on the surface. Obviously, like I have a lot of history with that. I've had that bicycle since I was in college. You know, I've had that bike for over 20 years probably. And, you know, like I rode it across the country, you know, and like I've gotten groceries on it a million times and, you know, lots and lots of bike rides with my friends and stuff like that. So there is like a history to it. But I feel like that stuff is like very internal to me, and I'm not really trying to like, I don't, you know, like express anything about my memories specifically.
Sure. And I think maybe, yeah, memory is a little too subjective. I think you sort of hit the nail on the head with what I'm seeing is more of just like an implication of history.
Yeah.
Where there is like, these objects are well used and imply, you know, a long relationship with whoever is using them.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, with this grill painting that's in the show, it's not my barbecue grill. It's a friend of mine's. But I have painted my grill, and I've painted a lot of my friends' grills. And they're all associated with like specific events or, you know, I mean, a barbecue is just like, the reason why I wanted to paint it is just like, it's a way for people to come together, you know. It's a great excuse to hang out with your friends is just to have a barbecue.
Right.
You know, and it like generally is, at least with my peers, it like gets more people to come hang out rather than like a, maybe a more formal dinner party or something
like
that.
Sure. Yeah.
But like it could be, you know, like it could be a painting of a dinner party, you know, like it's, if like that's like what you're into, you know, if you like dinner parties and you can think of like the grill as a way to have a sort of a dinner party or whatever. Uh-huh. But also like with the grills, it's kind of like, I feel like there's sort of like more universal maybe than like a dinner party or something, because like grilling has been a part of like many different cultures, even like different cultures in America, you know, it like, I mean, everyone grills, it seems like, even if you're a vegetarian, you like, you know, you can grill some veggies and hang out at the barbecue, you know, in the backyard. So,
yeah. I want to talk a bit about ambition, because I think one of the more challenging threads of, you know, modern life in America is this sort of idea of ambition, or maybe trying to have it all. And then the perception that if you are not pursuing a sort of like linear career or making work the prime focus of your productivity, to use an economic term, like that it can mean like you're a slacker, or you're kind of lazy. And we've heard those tropes for decades, but I want to talk about one painting that I think actually shows, I mean, is sort of a monument to some of your ambitions and what that means to you, which is Trash Ramp 3.0. Cause it's the subject matter is huge. And then it implies sort of a lot of activity around it.
Okay. So that painting specifically is, with ambition, I guess, specifically about that painting, is that painting is of a skate ramp that I built in my backyard. And I skate as a hobby. I've done it since I was in middle school, probably. And I've actually been building ramps my whole life. You know, I built a ramp in my backyard when I was 15 or 16. I've helped build ramps at skate parks in St. Louis, and I've built several ramps at my house now as an adult. And it's called Trash Ramp because most of the ramp, the lumber is pulled from construction dumpsters, which are a great place to get free materials. It's not always safe. I'm not saying that like it's the best way to get materials, but it is a way to do it on a budget. And I mean, like what you're talking about, like this, like sort of linear perspective of like your job, like career trajectory or whatever. I think like kind of with artists, like I was saying, people kind of like joke and say I'm retired, which I am very much not retired.
Right.
I wish I was retired. but like skaters also sort of get this like sort of slacker sort of stigma about them. And like, I mean, it's just as hard as any other sport.
It's probably harder than a lot.
Well, I don't want to say that.
Yeah.
I mean, baseball is probably really hard to play too. You know? But I mean, like, especially if you're like doing it at a professional level, I mean, like they're real athletes.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Like, I mean, it's like, it's so competitive now that, I mean, like you have to be in shape to do it, you know? I mean, but, and then like just sort of generally as like ambition and like work career and stuff like that, it just seems like, now like in our society, like people talk about like this period of time as the Great Resignation. You know, and it's a time where lots of people are choosing to leave their jobs because they feel like it's not worth it. And they like recognize, especially with the, you know, with like the pandemic and all these, you know, people were able to work from home and then they weren't able to work from home, or like they were forced to go into work when it like wasn't safe, or at least they didn't feel like it was safe. I mean, obviously some people were like very comfortable during COVID and like it didn't like scare them or whatever, but some people were scared and like,
yeah,
you know, having to go to a job that like you're scared to be at is like awful. But I think people also started realizing that they just weren't being treated very well by their employers. And it's like, I'm not putting up with this anymore. You know, like for the amount of like physical or mental, you know, sort of, I don't want to say abuse, but like exertion that you have to go through just to get a paycheck. That's probably not very much, you know, even if it is paying you enough, is it enough for like that amount of stress, you know?
Right.
And, it's something about our society that I have like never understood. And I don't know why that is. It's not like I like was brought up in some like socialist, communist, like household or whatever that was like anti-capitalism and stuff like that.
Right.
But I just like, I don't really get it. It seems like a lot of times, like the only reason people have a job is because whoever owns that business is making money off of them. You know, and as soon as you're not, you're gone.
Yeah.
You know? And like the fact that you have to have like a pretty good job to even have healthcare and stuff like that. It's just like, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, not to mention like you probably commute in your car, you know, like an hour or more every day. Like that's an hour of your day. You're not getting paid for. You don't get it back. It's stressful to sit in traffic. It's like bad for the environment. You know, I'm like, I'm not doing that. Yeah. I don't want to do that. You know?
Yeah. I understand. And I think there's something about it. I know you've done a lot of studying and reading about leisure studies, I think from like the early part of the 20th century, especially is where some of those, I remember some books that you turned me onto around that. And I think for me, one of the facts that really blew my mind was that the 40-hour work week was negotiated by unions. It used to be more. Like factories used to work people longer and harder and younger. And I think, you know, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on where we've gone on that, but also it's like some of the things that don't make sense in that intuitive way is because it's not coming from like the human element. It's coming from the like fundamentally treating human labor as capital and nothing without, you know, consideration for the fact that we're all living, breathing human beings. And
yeah. So I'm not an economics expert whatsoever. So if anyone's listening to this and they want to fact check me, I would appreciate it really. But, from things that I've read, you know, people have been advocating for shorter work hours. I mean, probably as far back as history goes, you know, I mean, but like specifically with like the unions and stuff like, you know, I have this button at home that says something about like, you know, thank a union member because they brought you the weekend. Because before people worked 7 days a week, you know, like there's nothing in our society that says a work week has to be 40 hours. That's like, when you're talking about like the human element, that goes both ways because like we as a human society have decided that, you know, like we could change it at any point in time. There's no rules of like, those are like laws of nature saying the work week is 40 hours. It's right. Like totally a human invention. But again, it's like also like just as seen as like a way to get capital. I mean, in my artist statement, I usually like use this quote from John Maynard Keynes about, and he wrote this in the 1930s that around our time now, 100 years later, we'd be working 15 hours a week because of the way technology advances and stuff like that. Obviously, it hasn't happened. But like, what if it did, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I mean, we could change it so easily if people just collectively decided that like, we're not going to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And but again, if people want to work, I mean, they can work. I'm not trying to tell anyone like how to live their lives by making artwork about leisure. I mean, I certainly, you know, between the studio and like part-time gigs that I have, I work more than 40 hours a week.
Right.
For sure. Yeah. But I don't want to. I would love to just have the studio job and probably not even 40 hours a week. 30 would probably be enough. There's just like so much stuff that I'd rather pursue. And I think like people would be happier if they were pursuing things that didn't make them focus on like their day job.
Right. Yeah. And I think we're kind of getting back to like a little, like almost to some of the stuff we were talking about on the, at the beginning of this, where, you know, it seems like at least the last, you know, I mean, maybe forever, but at least since the Industrial Revolution, like there's been a tension between some people wanting to utilize this increased production output to make life easier for everyone. And then some people want to use this increased production output to make people work more and generate more resources or capital or whatever it is. And I think that's, yeah, it is pretty fascinating that like we will, you know, at some point, yeah, we'll have to, if we want it to change, we'll have to collectively make a decision that like, this is just not important to us.
Yeah. I mean, it's, we're going to run out of materials at some point, you know, like we can't use stuff up faster than it like replaces itself.
Right.
And that's true for labor. I mean, you know, there's, I think maybe Kellogg's was in the news a couple years ago about like a labor dispute. Mm-hmm. But during the Great Depression, they actually went to a 6-hour workday instead of 8-hour workday. So people would end up working 30 hours a week. And then they hired 25% more people or 20% more people. So they were still working the same amount of, like the company was still working the same amount of hours per week, but each individual person was working less. But that way, instead of like laying people off during that time, they were actually hiring people and people were just working less. And there were like so many stories about how people, it was mostly like women working in that factory, I guess at the time, but like, and you know, women also have to do a lot of work at home, raising kids, cooking, cleaning, that kind of stuff, especially in the 1930s.
Sure.
Or post-World War II. And, it's just like, they talk about like, oh, I have so much more, you know, there's like extra 2 hours, like make my life so much better because I can like catch up on stuff or have some time for myself, or I can like engage in this hobby that I've been wanting to do. And, you know, eventually it was like taken away from them, the 6-hour workday. And it just like, it just makes me think like, what if instead of like that going away, that like became the industry standard or something like that, you know, like,
yeah,
there's like, there's a points in history where it's like, oh, what if that went the other direction,
right?
You know, it's kind of interesting to think about.
It is. I want to pivot a little bit because you've got two other pieces in this show that I know. So my history with you as an artist, the first time I met you was, oh gosh, 15 years ago, maybe. And you had a big show and it was a huge sort of mixed media production, which included a rug, an uncut rug, a complimentary pair of shoes called rug cutters, some glasses and things. And that show felt very mixed media. And the two pieces in this show that sort of speak to that to me are, there's a custom neon sign that says, "Not sorry, we're closed." There's an animation that I believe is called "Every Night is a Saturday Night."
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we have the individual illustrations from that animation displayed. And I'm curious, like, now you're doing a lot of painting, but do you, like, was it always that way, or was painting always the main thing, or has it sort of settled over the last few years?
I think painting's always been the main thing. But there was a time when other projects were certainly more part of my studio practice. And it's just because I like making a lot of different stuff. And, you know, there are a few like exhibitions I've seen like coming up, you know, as a young artist where, you know, whatever exhibition I would see, the artist was pursuing a project, like regardless of what materials it was, because they thought it would be interesting or they could make interesting work. And after I got out of college, where I was just a painter, that idea like spoke to me somehow for some reason. And so I was like, well, I want to make, you know, a sculpture too, or I want to make a drawing, or I want to make, you know, some textile pieces or something like that. And, I still do it to some extent, but I mean, for just like very like practical reasons, I get more exhibitions when I make paintings than when I make other stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I focus on that for basically a very simple reason that like, this has a potential to be shown, whereas like this weird sculpture I made doesn't, you know. I guess like maybe when you just like look at a few images from my portfolio, and there's a painting and a sound sculpture and a textile, even though they're all like related through their subject matter, visually it's like a little bit chaotic. Mm-hmm. But I still like to include them a little bit in my shows because I'm the artist and I get to do what I want. I just saw like a, you know, you always see these "sorry we're closed" signs. And I, as we've been talking, you know that I'm not sorry.
Yeah.
If I don't, you know, I don't think people should apologize for not wanting to be at their job.
Right.
Even if you're the owner of your company and yeah. like, if you don't want to be there, you should get a week off, you know? And I think in a way it also, I mean, some of my paintings are as simple as just a landscape painting, which maybe don't speak to contemporary art as much as maybe something like a mixed media piece does.
Sure.
So I think like including, maybe I'm using it as a crutch to feel like more like a contemporary artist, but I like making this stuff too. So it's not, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it could be seen as a crutch, I guess.
Yeah.
But I just thought it would be hilarious to have a "not sorry we're closed" sign.
It's pretty great.
And it's also, I mean, depending on where it's hung in the gallery, like it might confuse someone to thinking that the gallery's closed. And so it like makes the audience be a little bit more, I don't know, inquisitive. Like, wait, what's going on here? And the animation, like, as you're saying, it's the animation is of a calendar where all the days of the year are Saturday. Uh-huh. So it's 366 drawings of a, each drawing is a page from the calendar. It's 366 because I included February 29th
sure.
as if it would be a leap year, because if every day is going to be Saturday,
yeah, might as well
have that extra one. But yeah, they're not as much as my part of my studio anymore, just because I, you know, it's hard to do everything, you mm-hmm. know? And I feel like if I'm limiting myself to just paintings, I actually feel more productive because I can get into more of a workflow.
Right.
And there's just less clutter in the studio, and it's sort of, I don't know. We were talking about ambition a little bit earlier, and a lot of my projects are ambitious in their scale.
Yes.
The paintings here are mostly small paintings, but they're still like very ambitious small paintings with a mm-hmm. level of detail in them. But like the animation that's in the show is an ambitious project because it's 366 drawings, you know. It takes a lot of time to do a project like that.
Yeah.
So I do like to pick these projects that are ambitious and that are just going to be sort of like impressive to people based on just how complicated they are to make or how time consuming they are to make. And that's what a lot of my sort of non-painting pieces were. You know, I would, you know, make a pair of shoes from scratch, mm-hmm. you know, like you mentioned them, they have some knives and they're actually called dancing shoes.
Oh, okay.
But
oops, sorry.
That's okay. But, dancing shoes because, and with the knives in them, like the pun is like cut a rug.
Right.
You know, so, but you know, the rug was hand woven and it was 6 feet by 8 feet. It's not like a little doormat. It's mm-hmm. like a floor rug, you know? I just like tackling those big projects. It's like when you finish a project like that, the sense of like accomplishment that like I personally get from it is like, it's very important to me, I guess. Mm. And, but also I think like viewers like it, you know, if it's a painting that's like incredibly detailed or if it's a project that has like this big scope to it, they're like, whoa, look at this thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I really like watching people like, realize that this is like a handmade thing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, we had a moment yesterday where when you were setting up the show, you had somebody that they, it took them a minute to figure out that they weren't just photos, mm. right? And I, you know, I wouldn't describe your style in like the classical, like photorealistic thing, but you do pay a lot of attention to making things like sort of rigorously representative. And sometimes sometimes to a pretty deep degree with like something wildly ephemeral, such as, you know, the shadows on Trash Ramp 3.0, the shadows of the leaves of that tree. I mean, somebody could walk up and figure out what kind of tree is in your yard, even though they can't see it, just based on the shadows. And that seems to be, you know, a part of that process, is that that sort of meticulousness seems to be part of your voice a little bit.
So I want them to feel as real as possible. And I mean, I have like a little bit of an issue with the term photorealism. I get it as a compliment, and I appreciate that people recognize how well they're made, I guess. But I think from a art historical standpoint, and
I was trying to avoid
if you're an art historian, maybe you could maybe like clarify this, but I like think of photorealism as like a specific movement in art where people are specifically trying to copy the effects of photography.
Right.
Whereas I'm usually working from, even for a small painting, I'm working from maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 photos, and I'm trying to capture the way it looks like in real life. So maybe hyperrealism is a better term, but I just call them representational paintings.
Sure.
That's kind of, and like a lot of the paintings in this show, I'm painting things at life size. So the objects in the painting are the same size as you would see them as if you were standing in front of them. Not all the paintings, like the ramp painting is obviously smaller and the grill painting, but, and then there's a little beach painting. But basically everything else is life size. And even like the ramp painting in a way is life size because that's the view out of my back door. Mm-hmm. And if you were to hold a ruler up at arm's length,
that's exactly the size it would be.
That's like the size it would be.
Yeah.
So yeah, you do, like if you standing from the right distance away, it is life size.
Uh-huh.
But like, since I do want the paintings to feel very real, painting them at life size is like important for that feeling, I guess.
Yeah. You mentioned, you did mention the big CA, like contemporary art as a thing earlier. And I'm wondering, you know, as you get more experience in this and as you're, you know, you've been doing this for quite a long time, does that, do terms like that start to mean less? Like, do they represent a sort of like faster, more like over-concerned way of thinking about art, or is that something you, are you still trying to keep your thumb on the pulse?
I don't know. I struggle with it. I mean, I would say my thumb is not on the pulse.
Okay.
I go to less and less exhibitions probably every year. And I think part of it's, I just want to spend time in my studio.
Right.
You know, like there's an opening Friday night and I'm like working on a painting. I'm not going to stop working on a painting and go to the opening.
Sure.
Like, I mean, I do see exhibitions. I don't go to openings that much though. And I think like that's where you like put your finger on the pulse and like that's where you're like sort of part of the like local art scene and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, unfortunately, and I don't, I mean, like, I don't want to seem like I'm not supportive of the other artists and, you know, that I know, but I just like, I want to be painting, you know? And like, I don't really read like art magazines or publications anymore. And I try not to look at the stuff on social media just because it is like a little bit, I mean, you get like that FOMO, you know, like this person's getting a show here or they're getting a show there, or like they just got this residency or this grant or whatever. Or it's like, oh, I know this person sold that painting.
Right.
You know, and it like is depressing, just like, you know, when you want like those experiences also. And it's like, I mean, also I'm happy for my colleagues who are having success or whatever. And like, you know, I have a show and like people are going to see it and I don't want them to feel depressed, like that they don't have this show, but that's what social media does to us.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
So I would say, no, my finger is not on the pulse and I am more and more drifting away from like what is going on in contemporary art. Yeah. I just want to stay home and paint.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that like, you know, especially with social media and,
I hate that just, we even like are using the word social media right now.
I know. It's, I don't even like to talk about it, but just the idea of like, you know, we're getting to a point, for example, like in music, I always think about, and we might even be there at some point, I'll look up this statistic, but like We're getting close to the point where there's going to be more music released out into the world every day than a single person could listen to in their lifetime, realistically. And we're heading there. So it's just, it's out there. But like, there's a line, and I think it's shorter and shorter as we, you know, as you become more experienced and become like sort of slower and more deliberate in your decision-making and your, maybe slower is the wrong word, but more deliberate, in your decision-making, like when it comes to like art and everything, like seeing sort of like this smorgasbord of possibilities actually like can like, in my experience at least, can like cloud my judgment in terms of, am I writing the right style of music right now? Am I doing the right thing? I mean, the inverse of that is, you know, there's sort of unlimited beauty in the world to experience, but if you want to experience all of it, it's at the cost of that is making a coherent body of work.
Yeah. I mean, I basically just agree with you.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, there is just so much being produced, you know, and it's, I think it's great.
Me too. Yeah.
But it's, but I don't need to consume it all, you know, and it's just like the sort of like keeping up with everything is exhausting.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't want to do it. I feel like I've gotten to the point where like I can't make new friends. I can't get new hobbies because like I like my friends and I like my hobbies. If I pick up something new, something's gonna have to get cut out.
Right.
And that sucks.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, we've probably talked about this and like, I think a lot of people have, you know, like you get, once you have too many choices, like you can't make a decision. Mm-hmm. And it's like psychologists have like studied this. Like if you are given the choice of like two drinks, you can have, you know, whatever, drink A and drink B, or you could have drinks A through Z. You're ultimately going to be happier with your decision that you make between A and B versus A through Z.
Right.
Because you'll be more sure that you made the right one.
Yeah.
And like, you're talking about like being more deliberate with like the projects you pick and stuff like that. You know, it's like, cause I mean, I have a million ideas. It's like so hard because again, like I still want to be making stuff that are like non-painting artworks, but I like have had to just sort of like almost cut that out, exclude like completely from my practice because it's, I think everything is worse than it would be if I was just focusing on, I think the paintings I'm making now where I'm basically only painting in the studio are better because I'm focusing just on painting.
Yeah.
You know, if I was focusing on a new animation and a sculpture, you know, not to mention, you know, a day job and like, you know, making time to skate and making time to hang out with my friends and go see concerts and stuff like that, it would like, you know, the painting would suffer.
Right.
You know, and overall my like art practice would suffer. So I think like sort of, there is like something therapeutic about limitations.
Yes.
You know, think of them as a limitation, maybe it's like a negative term, but like it could be like a term that's sort of takes a weight off your shoulder also.
Sure. Yeah. I think, so. I mean, I think so. I mean, I think, yeah, there's the, just that thread. I mean, I think we're sort of seeing it sort of unravel a little bit, but just the idea of like, you know, having it all, like being a thing, like that's,
it sounds awful.
It does, right? It sounds exhausting.
I want the most basic stuff. Uh-huh. It's like, even like grocery shopping, I'm like, I just want the plain thing. Uh-huh. I don't need like the new improved item. It's like, whatever is the plain one.
Yeah.
Give me that one.
I had a very funny experience. So you know, not to endorse any particular grocery store, but I have become an Aldi guy living on this side of town. Love Aldi.
Just on the street.
But the thing about it, and the thing that I like, is it's so many less choices. Like they still have some, they have some like fancy stuff, and like you can get weird dips or whatever. But it's, you know, it's like they got their brand of Cheez-Its, and it's Cheez-Its. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just that. And I remember like I had been going to Aldi for probably 3 years or something, or maybe it was about a year ago. And I went to a big box store for the first time in several years. And it's like the variety for some of these things. Like, I think I counted like 14 flavors of Chex.
Yeah.
And it's like, and some of that stuff is like, that's the kind of stuff that I think is really...
It's exactly what's wrong with our society.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
that's what it feels if I could like. Be judgmental for a second.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
The fact that we think we need 14 different options of Chex cereal.
Yeah, and I don't think capital W, we do. I think Chex decides or like reacts to trends in other products doing this. No, it's like I have never once, eaten a bowl of cereal and been like, I really wish this was like strawberry flavored,
instead of just putting strawberries in
yes,
it.
Exactly.
Like you could do that at home.
Yeah. it's fascinating.
Well, it's like, yeah, I mean, people, like if it's advertised to somebody, like,
yeah,
it works. Advertising works.
It does.
Which is, yeah. I mean, now that like our society knows that, like all the psychological stuff that like they like understand around that stuff is like very terrifying.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, seriously, like the choice thing is, it's like been like, there's like so much scientific evidence that it's like bad for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I mean, debilitating almost.
Yeah.
You know, I have friends who are like terrified of the grocery store. Like they don't ever go grocery shopping
mm-hmm.
because it's just like
too much
panic mode, you know?
Right.
Yeah. We live in a society where people can't even go grocery shopping because it's too stressful.
That's one thing I actually like about some of those cooking shows where like when they go in to like rescue a restaurant, they'll be like, this menu is entirely too big. They'll be like, you're going to cook five things really well.
Yeah.
And like, I
those
love
are the
that.
Best restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Like if
I had a restaurant, I'd have one item.
Right.
But like we have this sandwich or whatever. Take it or leave it.
Yeah. And there was actually a little market in Fountain Square that did that, Wildwood Market. They had the sandwich of the day. And you know what? If I was in the neighborhood, I wouldn't even look. I'd just be like, whatever the sandwich is, like, I trust you. Like, you're good at making sandwiches, And there's something about that, and now it's sort of novel, right? That we have those sort of like, somebody being like, here's the one thing, take it or leave it. I love it though.
Yeah. But they are like, it's the oddball.
Yeah.
It's like, this is so weird.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh, that I'm specializing in something. That's what most people used to do.
Yeah. So Brian, is there anything else that, you wanted to cover about this show that I didn't hit explicitly?
Oh man, I should have been thinking about this.
That's okay.
Nothing is coming to mind. I just hope people come out and enjoy it. And if you like the show, I love to hear from people. So feel free to reach out to me if you have questions about it.
After lambasting all media, how do we contact you, Brian?
Well, you can get in touch with me. I do use Instagram. I don't post very often, but I check messages. Mm-hmm. So you can reach out to me on Instagram. It's just at Brian DePauly.
Okay.
All
right. Well, Brian, thanks for sitting down with us, and we're looking forward to the opening tonight.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.